fun.
Cheers.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
Israel has ordered a nationwide lockdown to deal with an increase in coronavirus cases. The new rules are to take effect Friday, at the start of the Jewish high holiday season. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the move on Sunday. Schools, restaurants, market areas, and hotels will close as part of the lockdown. Israelis will also face restrictions on movement and gatherings. I know that these steps come at a difficult price for all of us, Netanyahu told the nation. This is not the holiday we are used to. The new lockdown will remain in place for at least 3 weeks. Israel already had a lengthy lockdown in the spring. The move brought down infection numbers, but also hurt the country's economy, with many people losing jobs. Israelis usually hold large family gatherings and fill religious centers during the important holy day of Yom Kippur later this month. Officials feared that could fuel a rise in infections. A consideration in Israeli discussions about the lockdown was what prayers would look like during the Jewish holidays. The details on prayer during the lockdown were not clear in the government decision. That led Israeli Housing Minister Yaakov Litzman, who represents the Orthodox Jews, to resign from the government. Israel has had more than 150,000 confirmed cases of the new coronavirus and more than 1,100 deaths. With a population of 9 million, the country now has one of the world's worst outbreaks of the virus. More than 4,000 new cases are reported every day. Israel earned praise for its early efforts in stopping the coronavirus. The country moved quickly to close its borders and appeared to bring infections under control. It has since been criticized for opening businesses and schools too quickly, permitting the virus to spread. Much of the criticism has been aimed at Netanyahu. Thousands of protesters gather outside his Jerusalem home every week. The prime minister has appeared preoccupied by politics and personal issues, including his trial on corruption charges. Netanyahu has also been criticized for seeming to surrender to pressure from interest groups, including, most recently, his Orthodox governing partners. They seemed to have persuaded him to ease a city-based lockdown plan that would have mostly affected ultra-Orthodox and Arab communities. On Sunday, Netanyahu defended his earlier actions. He said Israel's economy had come out of the first lockdown in a better state than many other developed nations. And he said the country had had fewer coronavirus deaths than other countries with similar outbreaks. The government, led by two opposing parties who joined forces reportedly to fight the virus, also has been denounced for the new outbreak. Critics say it has failed to deal with both the health and economic crises, leading Israel to its second lockdown. But some government ministers are blaming the public for the spread. They accuse Israelis of violating rules on public gatherings and wearing face masks. I'm Katie Weaver.
For Bryant Atencia, the social and emotional well-being of his students is more important than his lesson plans. The coronavirus pandemic has affected students and their families in Laguna Province in the Philippines, where he teaches high school. Students are also facing what he calls a huge adjustment to distance learning. Atencia told VOA that before the health crisis started, he mainly taught from books and gave tests on the material.
But now, I try to touch the emotion, touch base with the students and their parents. I try to build up the relationship that would make the students more comfortable in taking lessons online.
Right now, teachers around the world are amending their lesson plans for online learning. So teaching social emotional skills, or SEL, may not be high on their to-do list. Yet some experts say these skills are more critical than ever. Christina Cipriano is director of research at the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence at Yale University in Connecticut. In an open letter to teachers after schools closed in March, she wrote, "Now is when we need to apply everything we've learned about SEL." She added that these are real skills that can support us in managing the roller coaster of emotions we will be having over the coming days and months. Atencia, who also trains teachers and teaches English at another job, was ready for whatever came. In May, he took online trainings on SEL and how to use it in the classroom. 1 month before his high school students began classes, he held weekly Zoom video conference meetings with them. His goals were getting students excited about distance learning and identifying their skills and needs. In one meeting, Atencia put the students into three separate online rooms and gave them a creative activity. He wanted to see how well they worked independently and in groups, and which ones would need the most support going forward. The Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, or CASEL, is a research and training organization. It divides social-emotional skills into five areas. They are recognizing and controlling one's emotions, setting and reaching positive goals, showing sympathy for other people, developing and keeping positive relationships, and making responsible decisions. The Yale Center's research found that emotions like happiness and curiosity support a person's ability to pay attention and have greater involvement in school. But emotions like anxiety and fear, especially over long periods, hurt one's ability to think clearly. Eileen Watts has witnessed this kind of anxiety in students firsthand. In her 20 years of teaching, she has worked with students from all walks of life, including those who were homeless and those requiring special education. She has also taught Iraqi children living in the United States. Watts says that over the years, she has often included some form of SEL in her lessons. Last year, she taught sixth graders at a school in McLean, Virginia. Some of the students were born in Iraq and had seen friends and family members killed. Watts said she and other teachers built in activities to help students reduce anxiety. Classes took brain breaks, for example, which meant stopping the lesson to play a short game or even do a dance. And if a child was feeling anxious, he or she could partner with someone to help calm those emotions.
I discovered that if they're stressed out, they don't take in new information. They don't participate.
Watts, who is based in Arkansas, has just begun teaching fifth graders online at Fort Belvoir, a U.S. Army base in Virginia. She said most of the SEL activities are built into the first part of the day and involve relationship building, dealing with social pressure, and recognizing one's strengths and weaknesses. A recent study of teenagers found that many struggled with depression, anxiety, and sadness during the mass school closures 6 months ago. Around 40% said they had not been offered any social or emotional support by an adult from their school. Watts told VOA that in addition to pandemic-related stress, spending 6 hours in an online class daily causes children more stress. So, she says, educators in Fairfax County, Virginia, are desperately trying to put together de-stressing activities. Students are not the only ones facing increased anxiety and stress because of the health crisis. After the pandemic began, the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence partnered with CASEL on a questionnaire for teachers. Within 3 days, more than 5,000 responded, saying they most often felt five emotions: anxious, fearful, worried, overcome, and sad. Some teachers feared that they or a family member would get COVID-19. Another cause of stress was having to deal with their own needs and their family's needs while working full-time from home. And there was anxiety around using new teaching technologies. Watts noted that the head of one Arkansas school asked its counselors to create de-stressing activities for the teachers. There, the teachers were facing increased pressure from problems involving the new technology. And some have family members who have lost jobs during the pandemic. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about Thomas Jefferson's second term as president. Historian Joseph Ellis calls it a disaster, defined by the trade embargo and the looming War of 1812.
When he leaves office in 1808, 1809, he really wants to get out of town and sort of lick his wounds.
In the months before he left office, Jefferson had signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter the United States, and no ships could leave. The purpose of the trade embargo was to keep America out of the war between Britain and France. But the embargo slowed the American economy. Many Americans opposed the trade ban. Jefferson's political opponents, the Federalists, used the issue to increase their strength in northeastern states. The year 1808 was, after all, a presidential election year. Thomas Jefferson had served 2 4-year terms as president. No law prevented him from running again. But Jefferson had decided years before that a president should be limited to 2 terms. Without such a limit, Jefferson believed, a powerful man might be able to keep the position for as long as he wished. George Washington had served 2 terms and then retired. Jefferson would do the same. Jefferson's Republican Party chose James Madison as its candidate for president. James Madison was Jefferson's Secretary of State. The party chose George Clinton as its candidate for vice president. The Federalist Party named the same candidates it had chosen 4 years earlier, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney for president and Rufus King for vice president. The Federalists felt sure they would win the election. They thought that Jefferson's embargo on trade had angered the people and turned them away from the Republican Party. Even some Republicans felt the election could go very badly for their party. But Jefferson remained calm. He believed that most Americans understood what he was trying to do with the embargo, and he believed they would vote for his party's candidate. Jefferson was right. Madison was elected. Thomas Jefferson left the White House in March of 1809. He believed the nation was in good hands with James Madison. He returned to Monticello, his country home in Virginia, and never went back to Washington again. Jefferson, who died in 1826, spent his retirement years following many of his interests. One was architecture. Jefferson continued building and remodeling his home, Monticello, throughout his presidency and retirement. The design was influenced by buildings he had seen in France and Britain. Monticello appears on one side of the American 5-cent coin, the nickel. Jefferson's face is on the other side. Jefferson also spent a good deal of his retirement writing letters. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was one of the great letter writers of his time. One of his famous correspondences was with John Adams. Adams was the second president of the United States. Adams and Jefferson had been friends during the first years of the United States, but politics had made them enemies. Their friendship ended after the election of 1800. Yet, in retirement, the two men became friends again. Jefferson and Adams had what Andrew O'Shaughnessy calls a remarkable correspondence.
They discuss the memory of the American Revolution and the history of it and how it should be written, but they also range over scientific and philosophical subjects.
Jefferson wrote about 19,000 letters in his lifetime. A project to publish the entire collection started in 1943 and is not expected to be completed until 2026. Jefferson also used his retirement to improve education in his home state of Virginia. Jefferson believed firmly in the value of education. His whole idea of government depended on the ability of citizens to make intelligent decisions. He proposed a school system of three steps. The first would be elementary schools, where all children could learn reading, writing, arithmetic, and geography. These schools would be built in all areas of the state and would be paid for by the people living in each area. The second step would be colleges, equivalent to the high schools of today. He proposed that 9 of these schools be built in the state. Students would begin the study of science, or would study agriculture, or how to make things by hand. These schools would be paid for by the state. The third step would be a state university, the University of Virginia, where students of great ability could get the best education possible. The university would produce the lawyers, doctors, professors, scientists, and government leaders. Young men whose families had money would pay for their own educations. The state would pay the costs of a small number of bright students from poor families. Jefferson also proposed that the University of Virginia be built at Charlottesville, a town near his home. Many of Jefferson's ideas for the university buildings came from the architecture of ancient Greece and Rome. Jefferson drew plans for the buildings. The buildings were very well designed. Work began on the university immediately, but it was 6 years before the school was opened to students. Jefferson was there almost every day, watching the workers. He was quick to criticize any mistake or work that was not well done. When he was sick and not able to go down to the university, he would watch the work through a telescope from a window of his home. The cost of the university kept growing, and Jefferson had to struggle to get the legislature to pay for it. He also worked hard to get the best possible professors to teach at the university. He sent men throughout the United States and even someone to Europe to find good teachers. Finally, in March 1825, the University of Virginia opened. Jefferson's health had suffered during his years of work on the university. He was 82 years old and feeling his age. He suffered from rheumatism and diabetes and was so weak he could walk only short distances. He knew he did not have much longer to live. He told a friend one day, "When I look back over the ranks of those with whom I have lived and loved, it is like looking over a field of battle, all fallen." As his health grew worse, Jefferson turned his thoughts to death. He wrote how he wished to be buried. He wanted a simple grave on the mountainside below his house. he drew a picture of the kind of memorial he wanted put at his grave. On this stone, he wanted the statement, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Virginia Law for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia." Jefferson had been governor of Virginia, secretary of state, and president. But historian Joseph Ellis says it makes sense that Jefferson would emphasize his contribution to the Declaration of Independence.
Those are the magic words of American history. There's 55 of them, and they begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." At the time that he wrote them, he didn't fully understand how important they were going to be. But they end up becoming the creed, the American creed. And that's his ticket to fame, the basis for his lustrous reputation.
But Joseph Ellis points out that Thomas Jefferson's reputation has suffered, especially among many historians. The reason, he says, is slavery. Jefferson owned over 150 slaves at Monticello.
He wanted to take the high moral ground and say that he knew slavery was at odds with the values of the American Revolution and the American Republic. A lot of people said that who were slave owners. But in the end, he says the federal government has no power whatsoever to do anything about it.
Joseph Ellis says Jefferson was against mixing of the races in society because he thought it would threaten the American Union. But he is believed to have had a relationship with a slave named Sally Hemings, who lived at Monticello. In 1998, genetic evidence supported the idea that Jefferson fathered children with her many years after his wife died. The historian says one reason people still find Jefferson interesting is the contradiction between his words in the Declaration of Independence and his personal actions.
He is the most resonant figure in American history because he simultaneously wrote the magic words about freedom and individual rights and equality, and at the same time was embedded in the great sin of American history, slavery and racism, so that he stands astride the great paradox that is the history of America.
On July 4th, 1826, Americans began celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. But then, from Boston, came news that former President John Adams had died. His last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." But Adams was wrong. At 10 minutes before 10 in the morning, on that same 4th of July, his friend Thomas Jefferson had died. Jefferson died at Monticello in his bed, surrounded by his family. As the news of the deaths of the two great men spread across the country, the celebrations turned to mourning and sorrow. Jefferson was buried the next day, as he had ordered, in a simple grave on the quiet mountainside. Thomas Jefferson continues to influence the United States, especially his words about freedom and democracy. And Jefferson's influence remained especially strong for James Madison. The fourth president had to deal with problems with Britain that Jefferson was not able to solve.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.